This is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. Knoxville's zoning ordinances haven't been fully reviewed in about 50 years, but in that time, the country has seen a rise in urbanization as people are returning to urban spaces like downtowns. Today, we're talking about RECODE, Knoxville's review of old ordinances and the effort to bring those codes into the modern age. We'll take your questions a little later in the program. I'm joined today by Jesse Fox Mayshark, who's the Senior Director of Communications and Government Relations at the City of Knoxville, Deputy to the Mayor and Chief Policy Officer Bill Lyons, and Dan Kelly, Deputy Director of the Metropolitan Planning Commission. And later on, I'll give you the number to call, and you can also tweet and Facebook message us. Gentlemen, let's start off with the basics here. Zoning ordinances are not the same thing as building codes. So who's going to explain the difference in those two things?
I'll go ahead. The zoning ordinance more or less puts out a plan for uses within a particular area, what you can do, what type of use you can do, what type of uses you can't do. The building codes deal with how far apart the two-by-fours have to be in a building, the electrical boxes and things like that. So there is a significant difference between the two.
How can you find out what zone you're in?
You can go to the website is kgis.maps, and the zoning map is available locally. And if you don't know what zoning you are in, the zoning ordinance itself, which would explain what you can do in each particular zone, is also available either on the city's website or MPC's website. And in the combination of the map and the zoning ordinance, you should know exactly what you can do and what your neighbor can do.
And what type of zones are there out there? Hundreds, right?
I think there's over 30 different zones that we have. If you want to think of them, they're based in broad categories of residential, commercial, industrial, office. There are special districts such as the Cumberland Avenue Overlay District, the Floodway Districts, things like that. But there are numerous residential districts, numerous commercial, and three or four industrial districts.
And I may break in here a minute. Yeah. This is Bill. We've had a fairly recent development in all of that. Dan mentioned Cumberland, which is form-based code, which actually gets into where on the lot you build and some things that are more about the way the structures address the street and such, and generally not so much on uses. And we have that in Cumberland, and we have that in the South Waterfront. That's a whole other conversation to have.
And were those created more recently than these other ones, kind of like a special case?
Yes, they were created, again, to guide development, especially Cumberland. We found that the zoning that we had, and we'll get into this, I'm sure, that mostly evolved and grew up in a suburbanization period really wasn't adequate for a much more dense development that we envisioned on Cumberland that was suitable for Cumberland. So rather than talking so much about setbacks and required parking and all those sorts of things, it much more came to, well, what are the heights and the manner in which the structure addresses the street and that sort of thing. And Cumberland had cried out for that, and the South Waterfront being a tremendous priority gave us a lot of opportunity to put that in place to guide development.
Interesting. Now, what is a commercial corridor?
If you want to think of just about every major street heading out of downtown, and I'm talking about Kingston Pike, Chapman Highway, Broadway, Central Street, those are commercial corridors. If you look at, particularly if you want to go out Kingston Pike, you see a mix of various types of retail and office uses that extend for miles out Kingston Pike, and that would be a commercial corridor.
And there's a lot of attention now on corridors, aside prior to RECODE, mentioning Kingston Pike, a lot of folks became somewhat frustrated to say we'd like to have mixed use along the corridor. And that zoning, again, going back to the older model, was based on segregating and separating uses, residents be over here and commercial, onto itself or unto itself. And downtown being the model, a lot of people wanted the opportunity to live maybe above where there was office and commercial out along the corridors as well. And we had series, MPC had a series of meetings and has been addressing that, and that'll kind of be folded into the greater RECODE effort as well. But the corridor zoning challenge has been then one that's out there.
Yeah, and this is Jesse. I just wanted to mention that the traditional zoning model that we have is often referred to as Euclidean zoning, which is not a mathematical term, but is named after Euclid, Ohio, which was a town in Ohio that was one of the first to adopt this zoning approach, which takes a very sort of segregated approach to zoning, where you kind of have your residential areas, which is just residential, and then your commercial areas, which are just commercial, your industrial areas, et cetera, kind of separating all of those things out. And what we're seeing demand for in recent years is combined uses. And if you think about downtown Knoxville, it's a very mixed use area where you have commercial uses, restaurants and so forth on the ground floor. A lot of times you might have offices on the second floor and then apartments or condos above those. And you kind of have that whole live, work, play in one area. And there's a lot of interest in that now, as we see with downtown, and people are starting to want to do those kinds of uses in other parts of the city. And so that's one of the things that this RECODE effort is looking at, is how do you kind of meet those demands and break down some of those walls that had been erected between all these different parts of the city, while at the same time providing adequate protections for the people who are in those areas.
And when you talk about the city's vision, I mean, when you talk about walkability and bikeability and public transportation and all of the things that they enable and work with a denser environment that you referred to, having the Euclidean separation means pretty hard to get from the residents to the retail to the office. And that's something that, though, would seem to make sense at what period in the country's existence we were all spreading out a very automobile-centric environment that guided that. Now there's a push toward a lot of, we need the opportunity to have walkability and bikeability that is not so automobile dependent.
And it makes great sense for the city to try to foster redevelopment of these corridors, because the infrastructure is already in place. Mm-hmm. The city has already made the investment. The public transit is already going up and down these major streets. So from that standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to focus investment, and one of the goals of the redoing the zoning ordinance is to be able to try to foster investment into areas that are in need of redevelopment.
One thing I was doing was looking at recodeknoxville.com and looking at some of the comments on there, and it occurs to me that some people may be more familiar with terminology than others. So we'll just go quickly through a couple of things that caught my eye. And for listeners out there who are wanting to participate in this, you may be interested in some of these things, like what are setbacks?
Setback is how close a building can be built to the property line. In most residential, the standard residential setback in most neighborhoods is probably 25 feet from their property line. Most people would go, well, my house is sitting back further than that. The right-of-way for the street extends beyond the edge of the pavement, and then you have your property line, and then the setback is behind that.
Okay. And what are impervious covers?
Impervious covers are areas that the water will not penetrate. When you have rain or snow or whatever, you know, the water's going to sit there. It's going to run off pavement, concrete, rooftops. That's all impervious.
And what about accessory structures?
Accessory structures are uses that are accessory to a particular use. A house may very well have an accessory structure as a detached garage or a shed or some such as that. Businesses have accessory structures that they store equipment in that are outside of the main building that they do business in. Accessory structures are ancillary to and have less square footage than the primary structure on the property.
And these are all things that might or might not be addressed by zoning ordinances, right?
They are addressed and will continue to be addressed.
Well, and I say might not because one thing that was interesting to me was after hurricanes came through Texas, found out that Houston has no zoning ordinances. And so it's kind of, but their claim is that the free market decides. So if someone wants to put in a hog rendering plant next to a neighborhood, chances are they're not going to do that because the economic pressures would make them recalcitrant to set up shop next to a bunch of people who are going to maybe complain about the smell or the noise or whatever. I mean, do you think that that would be feasible in Knoxville?
Well, somebody talks about the basic tenet of zoning, and, you know, everybody wants to be able to do whatever they want to do on their own property, and that's fine. However, they want to control what the guy that lives next to them does on his property, and you can't have both. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, you know, zoning came about, and we have situations where, as they were talking about, separation of uses, that's been the model for many, many years. And now we're moving away from that and back toward, really, what goes around comes around. If you think about the old city and the old neighborhoods that are around, you had mixtures of residential and the mom-and-pop grocery store and things like that, because everything was at a walkable scale. Mm-hmm. And there's a demand now for walkability, being able to get from point A to point B on a bicycle, things like that. And so from that standpoint, we're kind of moving back, but we're moving forward at the same time.
What's old is new again. It's sort of nice to think.
Well, and I also think something that's important here is that these are all political decisions. Like you talk about Houston not having zoning. That's obviously a decision that the city and the residents there have made over a long period of time. And zoning codes reflect the desires of the people who live in the city, who vote in the city. I mean, all of our zoning documents are, you know, written up at the direction of elected officials who are responding to different demands and different interests.
Right. And, you know, the political culture has been changing drastically. Everything we've been talking about points to that. All of those pressures, and they're still out there today, and there's a valid conversation to be had, but had previously been about getting as much separation as possible and isolation of uses as possible. It's fairly recent. You could have come to city council meetings for years and never heard the phrase mixed use, mm-hmm. and now it's quite common in discussion, and most people know what that is, and mostly it's seen as a positive.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back in just a minute or so, and we're going to start taking your calls. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. And this is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. Today we're talking about RECODE. This is Knoxville's working process, I should say, to sort of look at the codes, the ordinances, zoning ordinances that we've had. We haven't looked at those in like 50 years, so we're taking a look at those and hopefully modernizing those. I'm joined today by Jesse Fox Mayshark, Bill Lyons, and Dan Kelly. And we were talking just a minute ago about some of the basics, and I'm interested now in thinking about the future. How much of this can we future-proof? I mean, how much of this can we really project? You know, we said, okay, it's been 50 years. We had a different model then. 50 years before that, we had really a different model as well. And so what does the next 50 years look like, and how can we plan for that?
Start with one thing, and that is, we have not taken a holistic look at the code for 50 years, but it's been tacked and added to and and turns into this almost a multi-headed monster over time, which has necessitated this effort. So I imagine once this is done, that'll start happening, because there'll be some unforeseen developments. There'll be technological advances that we maybe see out there that become real, especially having to do with transportation along corridors. And who knows what other pressures will come just because of the society changing in ways that we are difficult to see too far out on. But all of this is an attempt to look toward the future.
And I also think that one of the things that's being discussed through this process, and again, no decisions have been made on this. This is all being discussed, and is being discussed publicly, and we're looking for input from people, but is to come up with a code that is inherently more flexible. One of the things that's been suggested is that maybe we have too many individual zones right now, and we get very specific about identifying in this zone you can do this, and in that zone you can do that. One potential model is to come up with some broader categories that would allow a greater range of uses within them, so that as new demands, as new technologies come along, we can accommodate those without having to do the things we've been doing in recent years, where somebody comes up with a business, say, that they want to open in a particular part of the city, and we don't have a code that really allows for it, and we understand why they want to do it, and maybe there's a demand for it. And so we've had to do a lot of sort of piecemeal variances and exceptions and waivers and things So it would be nice to come up with a code that could allow for, you know, the creativity and innovation of the future.
And one good example of that, and Dan could speak more to this if he'd like, is we had a variance request that came up recently where somebody, what he got down to, what is the definition of a drugstore? Or, you know, so if it does, what has to happen in a CVS type or a Dollar General? I mean, can they provide medicine? Do you have to have prescriptions? And even though it may have looked pretty much the same, it got quite animated as to whether that use was appropriate in that zone. And those are the things, because we have so much specificity in the definitions right now. And I think Jesse alludes to a very important point, you defining the uses a little more generally. Now, again, every time you do that, there is a segment of the population that goes, well, wait a minute, I'm not sure I trust that. So it's one that's going to take a lot of effort and trust and good wordsmithing to move forward.
I think the discussion has been of trying to come up with a more generalized list of uses, but I think the ordinance is also going to lay out clear guidelines that will allow people to understand what can happen. And if you're on the other end, if you're wanting to develop or build, you know the rules that you have to abide by, because right now there is a lot of give and take during the development review process that sometimes the citizens are concerned about what's going to happen and are not part, do not feel that they're part of the process.
As a matter of fact, one person was on the Recode Knoxville site and posted that they were talking about developers. One person was very upset with what they called predatory businesses, like payday loan companies, title pawn businesses, and they said some cities have limited or banned those businesses. I mean, do you see that sort of thing happening? Can you get that granular?
Well, one of the 115 amendments that have been made to the zoning ordinance since the year 2000, and I didn't go back any further, there's probably that many that go back into the 80s also. One of those deals with these payday loan businesses, and there have been standards that were included in the zoning ordinance that deal with separation of those particular uses. You can't just ban, you know, they're a legitimate business, and you can't just ban them. However, there are some measures that we can take as the city to separate and try to not get them to concentrate all in one place.
And just a reminder, you can ask questions of our panel either via Facebook or Twitter at WUOT-FM or via phone, 974-5050. And, you know, to that point, though, one of the things that strikes me as the idea here, or one of the ideas with zoning, is preserving a neighborhood, right? Preserving the character of that neighborhood. So you wouldn't put a high-rise, of 80-story building next to a bunch of historic, you know, one-story mission-style homes or whatnot. How do you do that? I mean, maybe we could talk about the historic overlay, and how does that protect a neighborhood, say, like Park Ridge?
Well, I mean, historic overlay itself is a zone, although it is, like you say, it's an overlay. So you have the underlying zone there, which is, a residential zone, and then the historic overlay imposes a set of guidelines and restrictions on what you can do with those properties if you're going to modify them or say you want to demolish one. I mean, there are a whole bunch of extra steps that get put in there with the express goal of preserving the historic structures that are there. And I think that whole question of protecting existing neighborhoods, I mean, we've been very clear from the beginning of this process that is important. And we, when we talk about bringing in more mixed use and more flexibility, a lot of times, you know, neighborhood associations say we'll get very nervous about, well, does this mean you're going to put, you know, a 15-story apartment building on my block that's all two-story houses? And no. But I think that also recognizing that we are going to grow as a county, we're going to grow as a city, and that there is a lot of demand for people who want to live closer to downtown, closer to the urban center, and that density itself provides a lot of benefits in all sorts of ways, from a sustainability perspective, from a transit perspective. You know, balancing the demand for more density with protecting the historic character of the neighborhoods that people have bought houses in and invested in. You know, those are both very important priorities, and there will be places where they come into conflict right now. You know, every city council meeting has one or two rezonings where, so, and a lot of times it's a small change. Someone wants to go from, you know, a C3 zone to an O1 zone or vice versa, and those things have certain stipulations that go with them, and you'll get a neighborhood group that doesn't like it and the developer that wants to do it, and city council spends a lot of time wrestling with all of those. And no matter how we rewrite the zoning code, that will probably continue to be the case, and you'll probably have a lot of individual cases on the borders of all of these areas.
Right, and that the once you look into these situations, you see how complicated they are. I mean, once you get into an overlay, they almost always have design standards and guidelines associated with them. That's why they're there, that are not otherwise in place. They also almost always prevent demolitions unless they get approval. There are ways to do them, but they take review. Somebody doesn't have the, quote, right to just demolish a building within an H1 or a neighborhood conservation zone, which is sort of H1 light in a way, the NC zone. And this is, but they're not isolated discussions just of structures. They get into does this make the neighborhood less affordable if you put those demands on somebody who may want to change the structure, and then you bring up a whole range of other issues that some people didn't see as related, but others see as very much intrinsically related. So the zoning is like everything else. It doesn't exist in any kind of a vacuum just about structure. It gets into a whole lot of other very challenging issues.
Speaking of issues, we've got a caller on the line, and they've got a question about case law. Leland, you're on the phone.
Yes. I noticed you've been talking a lot about this new form-based zoning, and that hasn't really worked out so well for you down there on the Cumberland Strip, because you wanted to avoid tall buildings built right up to the sidewalk, but that's exactly the kind of development that we're seeing there. And I'm really kind of concerned, and want you to talk about, if you would, address this kind of rush into form-based zoning when there's so little case law around it. So when you move to this form-based zoning, you basically just hand over the reins to the developers, because there's so little case law that cities end up losing almost everything. So if you could address that, please, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Leland.
Well, I could start with that, Leland. Appreciate your calling. We've talked with Leland on some other issues. The intent of Cumberland is to get larger buildings built to the street. That's what the intent is. And to get away from the zoning model that has the parking lot in front and the lesser structure back away, which is a suburban model. So we think Cumberland, the form-based code does guide the development, and we think that's all a plus. And the form-based codes have been around a while. Dan might want to know more about the background, but they've been in other cities, and they're not for every place at all, and that's why they're very limited to certain areas when appropriate. A lot of people have come in and said, well, maybe form-based code. And one of the first things we go is, well, form-based code is not the answer at all in most of the city. But in some areas of the city, it makes an awful lot of sense.
Like Bill said, the form-based codes have been around for some time. And I believe he stated earlier, and one of the basic tenets of the form-based code is you're talking more about design standards, what you're wanting, what the city is wanting the area to look like, as opposed to defining specific uses. And typically the developers have a higher standard to come up to. You know, on Cumberland Avenue, there has to be a higher percentage of glass along the street, of the glass fronts on the building. You know, the idea of being able to look into a commercial, it has to be commercial on the first floor with a residential element above. Does not necessarily have to be residential above, but that has been the case that we've seen so far. There is quite a demand for housing around the UT, and there are developers who are eager to try to satisfy that demand.
And we've got another caller with a couple of questions about zoning and entire city code. John, you're on?
Yeah, this is John Wilkins. And is this just zoning, or is it the entire city code and ordinances, and to what extent will there be review as well of administration procedures, policies, enforcement, accountability of city employees? I've been brief enough. I've got a couple of others I'd like to ask, but I don't want to intrude.
This is just looking at the zoning code, which is actually an appendix to the total city code of ordinances.
Okay. And what about the second part of it? What extent will there be review as well of administration and such?
Well, the administration of the zoning code certainly is built into this, if that's what you mean.
Okay. Will there be regard for civil rights and due process and constitutional compliance? We talk about 50 years. There has been a lot that has happened as far as our awareness of civil rights in this country in that 50 years. And one last question, is the city code considered civil or criminal? Civil or criminal law?
Well, this part of the code is definitely civil. Right. But we don't have, there are some criminal aspects to the city code that with limited application, but this is all civil here.
You can be issued a citation for zoning code ordinances. I think those citations are limited to $50 by state law. So you can be cited for violating the zoning code, but right, it's a civil code.
Can you be jailed?
I don't believe so. I mean, under city ordinances, the maximum penalty is a $50 fine. I mean, eventually, if you don't comply with enough of them, I think there is some point at which you have some exposure. But that's not that. For the most part, there's not any jail associated.
It's
with
it's
these.
Not something that comes up. Let's say, yeah, we're not familiar with any cases where that's happened.
Fine and jail are written into several ordinances that I know of.
Most people, when they violate the zoning ordinance, they don't even know that they're violating the ordinance. And when it's brought to their attention, the person that they're dealing with from the building inspections department, typically they will give them guidance on how to get legal and not have a violation, a notice of violation out there. And most people really try to comply once they've been notified that they're out of conformance with the zoning.
John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And so one thing I want to think about, too, is he mentioned a little bit about civil rights. I'm also thinking about the environment, and that's something else that obviously we're trying to balance here. What sort of effect does zoning have on, say, watersheds and water supply?
Well, of course, density and impervious areas and things like that that you've mentioned earlier certainly have impact on stormwater. Stormwater is a byproduct of, stormwater is, you're going to have that with every rain, but the more intense development that you have, the more stormwater that you're going to generate because of the more impervious surfaces. The zoning code unto itself has, in most cases, open space requirements, maximum lot coverage provisions. So from that standpoint, there are things written into the code to try to minimize that. However, the stormwater ordinance, the city has a stormwater ordinance that is administered by the city engineering department, and there are provisions in there for trying to minimize the impact on water quality, and that's the primary thing that we're trying to address through stormwater control, in addition to trying to keep structures from not flooding, but water quality is a very important aspect of that also.
Yeah, and one of the worst things for flooding and for water quality and stormwater issues in general, as we all know, is vast expanses of concrete, which you get with giant parking lots in particular. And so, again, trying to move toward toward denser, say, residential development, getting away from the kind of commercial development where you have, 300 parking spaces and a store at the very back of the lot and so forth. We have things that our engineering department has been doing to encourage and even provide sort of development bonuses for people using pervious materials. We have parking lots around town that are where people are using pervious pavers, where there's room for the water to actually soak into the ground on site instead of running off. It's definitely a challenge, but it is something that can go hand in hand with denser development if you do it right.
Right. The whole parking lot discussion really hits at the core of a lot of what we're talking about. Jesse referenced the, you know, seas of asphalt. That's what causes the environmental issues. Well, up till recently, all the discussion was we've got to require this massive amount of parking to account for what might be the peak use of a place. And we've seen that a lot of that seems to have been excessive, and that we needed, because it never allowed for anybody, any pedestrian or bicycle access, and had all these other negative consequences for the environment associated with it. And that's why we had a very long, an MPC and the city took a great look at parking requirements recently. That's something we got into prior to RECODE because it demanded our attention.
And by encouraging vertical development, the rooftop for a single-story structure that's 50 by 50 is the same amount of impervious area as a five-story building that's 50 by 50. So from that standpoint, density unto itself doesn't create impervious areas or problems. It's the amount of asphalt that's sitting out there.
Gotcha. All right, we're going to take another break real quick. You are listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. And this is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. Just a reminder, you can send us questions either via Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM and via phone at 974-5050. And we do have a question from Lynn on Facebook. She writes in, other cities like Nashville, Memphis, and Durham rely on historic zoning to guide development in older neighborhoods and preserve existing affordable housing. City Council committed to the MPC's 2014 Central City Sector Plan to preserve all National Register historic districts and structures, but recently stalled the MPC recommendation to expand the Edgewood Park City Historic Overlay in Park Ridge at Mayor O'Hara's behest. Does Mayor O'Hara still support the Council-approved 2014 Central City Sector Plan for historic resources? And if so, what is the mayor's timeline for realizing the plan, and how might RECODE process affect that timeline?
Well, we definitely support the vision of the sector plan, I think, and Mayor Rahero does. Now, the implementation is always another matter. And, of course, the H1 discussion in Park Ridge was put on hold for further involvement of people in the neighborhoods just because to allow for some resolving of a lot of other issues. But it's still in process, and we're hopeful there can be a good resolution to that. So that doesn't that taking that step for this particular H1 is more on the implementation end and the health of the community and the involvement to make sure that we proceed carefully with that rather than any kind of rejection of the notion of historic overlays.
And we've got a question on the phones. Chelsea. Hi there.
Hi, this is Chelsea.
Yeah, so what's your question?
My question is, the mayor recently delayed an action on the Metropolitan Planning Commission's recommendation to protect Knoxville's largest National Historic District in Park Ridge. Can you explain how RECODE might affect the timeline for Park Ridge's historic overlay? And what solution does RECODE offer that protects both affordable housing and historic structures in Knoxville?
Right. Well, and this is following up on the other question we just had. And I don't think anything about the RECODE process in and of itself will affect the timeline for what happens with the historic overlay in the Park Ridge area. I mean, of course, the H1 is an overlay. It is part of the zoning code, and so that's historic overlays are part of the code that will be reviewed along with everything else, but I don't think anyone is talking about wanting to, you know, substantially alter or get rid of our historic overlays. The concerns that came up in Park Ridge around affordability and sort of the future of the development of that neighborhood are serious ones, and they're complicated ones. And I think one thing that happened was that very specific issue of whether to extend the overlay got sort of used as a proxy by a lot of people for concerns that went well beyond the overlay itself, and that overlay process wasn't really well equipped to deal with those much broader questions. I was just at a meeting of the Park Ridge Community Organization on Monday where there was some discussion about how the neighborhood group is going to move forward and what kind of conversations need to happen there. And you know, city staff and MPC will certainly be very involved in those. And I think starting very quickly, that was one of the concerns at the neighborhood organization was, well, what is the timeline for this? And the mayor and city staff are going to be meeting with residents and stakeholders there in the neighborhood. And I know the neighborhood organization has an election coming up where they're going to have a new board. And so we hope there will be conversation very soon within the next few months about that. And Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think anything about the recode process itself is really going to affect that.
Not going to impact the H1 or the process that's underway right now. You know, that's a citizen involvement process, and as there are two sides to every argument, and eventually there will be a decision that will be made one way or the other.
I think this all does point to one of the things we discussed early in the program, which is there are a lot of complicated issues involved in land use. And in this case, whether people will argue to the degree they should have been interrelated, but the preservation was pitted somewhat against affordability, and many of course challenge that, but those are larger discussions that we need to have because there's a great concern for both in our city right now.
One of the issues, or one of the things that the consultants had identified in the initial report that we got from them, is that in the older neighborhoods, I refer to them as the inner ring neighborhoods, the older neighborhoods that are inside 640 and some of the neighborhoods in South Knox and areas like that, they're very hard. Those properties are very hard to deal with right now because they're being forced to develop or redevelop under the suburban zoning requirements. And those lots were created at 50 feet wide or 20 feet wide, or excuse me, 25 feet wide or 50 feet wide, and the minimum standard right now for a residential lot in the city is 75 feet wide. So when somebody wants to go in and do something in one of the neighborhoods, which is generally considered where the affordable housing is located, it's very difficult to do. So I would anticipate that that's going to be addressed in the new code.
Chelsea, thanks for your call. And I actually want to follow up on that a little bit because it's interesting to me. I have a lot of friends in South Knoxville, and one of the things they talk about is walkability. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everybody wants sidewalks. I live in Fountain City. I would love to have sidewalks in my neighborhood. It sounds like a freeway outside my house, even though it's a two-lane road. And I think there's a lot of places like that. But obviously, sidewalks are extremely expensive. So what in this process have you looked at in terms of encouraging sidewalks?
Well, again, I think through the zoning process and through the development standards that are going to be in place with various types of development, I think you will see sidewalks being a part of the amenities and or that will be provided when development occurs. The city has a stake in this also, and the city has a sidewalk development program. It is, as you say, they're expensive, but at the same time, where there's momentum through the redevelopment or development process, I think you can expect the city to probably jump in at some point and be involved in that also. But sidewalks are out primarily in the corridors that we've been talking about redeveloping. So from that standpoint, again, existing infrastructure, take advantage of it while it's there.
And we're still recovering as a city from annexing massive amounts of areas that were built without sidewalks. And the whole sidewalk discussion is really twofold. It's as development occurs, especially along corridors, then you can see the great sidewalks going in. We can see that as part of the process. But going back and retrofitting sidewalks where they are not is a whole different challenge, and involves ways of acquiring, you know, the challenge of acquiring the property and the easements from people. I mean, it is very expensive. Now, but I will say this, sidewalks are a priority, and the mayor is putting much more into the sidewalk budget and during that process, and that's something that people want now. So that's I think we'll have a lot more discussion of how much the demand for sidewalks and how we meet that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to think of sidewalks as part of our transportation infrastructure. They're not just like a nice place to go take a stroll after dinner. It's how a lot of people get from their home to, say, the bus stop or the store or wherever they're going. And as Bill said, the challenge that we have is, You know, we have a city that went through a huge amount of development sort of in the second two-thirds of the 20th century when everything was being built on the assumption that everyone was going to drive everywhere. And you can see as you go out from downtown, I live in Oakwood-Lincoln Park. My section of Oakwood-Lincoln Park has sidewalks. It was built in the mid-30s. If you go two blocks north, which was built about 5 years later, the sidewalks end. And that's right, and that happened all across the city. And so going back in and trying to, you know, build those sidewalks now is difficult and expensive.
And one thing that's also come up, at least in my research with things like smart cities, are things like transportation zones. And so mixed mode transport, right? So someone may drive their car, like you were suggesting, drive their car, say, to a place. Maybe we're going to have a bike share system very soon. Maybe they drive to a place, they grab a bike, and then they go into downtown so they don't have to worry about parking. What are ways that our zoning rules can encourage that sort of mixed mode transportation?
Well, I think, again, the density that we're talking about, trying to provide centralized services, things like that, will allow people to possibly drive to a short distance and go for the commercial uses, work, everything like that, as opposed to having to drive long distances. We've had park and ride lots in Knoxville and Knox County for many years, and when the economy's bad or the gas prices are high, people ride the buses, go to the park and ride lots, and, you know, use them quite a bit. But when times are good, that ridership falls off significantly. I think the idea is to try to be able to make that just a way of life. And I think people, or younger people in particular, are trying to get away from the car. They're trying to get to a way where they can use their car minimally.
That definitely does seem to be the future case. And one thing too, that this may not be zoning related, but I've seen that we're putting in technology in the city that seems to be advancing us towards maybe autonomous vehicles and that sort of thing. I am curious, one thing too, we mentioned Cumberland Avenue and sort of special case there. How do zoning ordinances within the city interface with the University of Tennessee?
Well, the university, first, is not covered by our zoning ordinances. We can start there. We had much cooperation with UT when the whole Cumberland project, and you can see a lot of their landscaping and what they're doing in the campus as it meets Cumberland will complement that well. But we obviously, Cumberland was the density and vision there and the amount of use and activity was predicated largely upon the number of university students who would be walking to class rather than driving in from further out, and that demand they would create for the businesses and so forth. So we are very conscious, obviously, of UT, and it very much was a major component in Cumberland. In fact, they actually participated in funding some of it at an early stage.
If let's say someone has a neighbor they think may be violating codes, what do they do about that? What's the process?
They call the City Building Inspections Department and voice their complaint, and it will be investigated. The city has two fellows that are primarily involved in the zoning violations or investigating zoning violations. And somebody will show up and knock on the door and go, "Are you doing so-and-so?" And it'll go from there.
And that's probably not going to change with recode, right? That's one of those things that's not broken. No need to fix it.
Zoning has been enforced by complaint. People, since there's only two people that do it, they don't drive around looking for zoning violations. But from the standpoint, once one is received, they do act on them.
There has been a criticism voiced that, say, developers and maybe architects have had an undue influence on this because they stand to benefit from certain zoning ordinances. What would you say about that?
Well, they're in interest. We have all sorts of interests who weigh in. I mean, obviously, they want to be able to build what they think their customers will want and pay for. We hope what we've striven for is to have development that is consistent with the desires of people around. Say, for instance, downtown, most of the development has been very much appreciated by people who live there. I'm among them. But there's going to be a natural tension there. And if you look at all the people and the committees that are advising it and the task forces, there's representation from all segments, neighborhoods, developers, architects, people interested in environmental concerns, And real estate. There are many interests out there who definitely see a stake at this, and developers have an interest, and sometimes those interests collide with others, and sometimes they don't, and that all has to be balanced out in this process.
One of the initial things that occurred after this process began was the mayor appointed a group that was called the Stakeholders, and it's 20 individuals who represent a very broad range of interests. You have the commercial realtor interests, you have homeowner interests, you have environmental interests, you have bicycle interests. You know, there are lots of different interests represented on the stakeholder committee. In addition to that, at the present time, MPC has a request for proposals out for someone or some organization to design and implement an outreach program. We have had contact with nearly 2,300 people so far through the RECODE process, but we realize there are segments of the community that we have not been able to get to, and this outreach program will try to bring primarily the African-American community and the Hispanic community into the process, and hopefully we will have a very broad range of participation throughout the entire review process.
We've got about 3 minutes or so remaining. I'm curious if these new zoning rules can encourage affordable housing developments as well.
As I stated earlier, most of the what people would consider affordable housing is located within the 640 ring, and those lots are held to the same standard as the lots outside, the suburban lots. And I think the new zoning ordinance will address that. I don't know that for a fact, but I believe it probably will. I think from the standpoint of being able to increase densities in particular areas, that will enhance affordability. There are probably other options out there, but I think those are the two primary ones right now.
And those don't have to be in conflict. I mean, we just had a zoning decision and support by near neighbors for affordable housing near off of Chapman Highway. But obviously, there's going to be a sensitivity by people who live in the area of affordable housing. We think that with the right amount of the appropriate land use guidelines, plus involvement of the communities in discussion and people's realizing that affordable housing is essential, that this can all work.
And one sort of parting question here. We've got about a minute or so left. When will the zoning map be updated?
The zoning map is part of the process, and we're hopeful to have the zoning map ready at the time the ordinance itself, the text, is presented to City Council. Right now, the timeline would have March would be the first public review, and hopefully by October there will be a zoning ordinance that will be close to being ready to go to City Council.
Jesse, any parting thoughts? You got about 30 seconds.
No, well, I would just say on that affordability question, because I know it came up a couple of times, one of the things that we know drives housing becoming unaffordable is when there's more demand than supply. And so to whatever degree we can make it more possible for, say, density, for more development of housing in these areas close to downtown where people want to live, that will help protect the affordable housing that already exists there.
Thank you to my guests, Jesse Fox-Mayshark, Bill Lyons, and Dan Kelly. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News.